once again about God's incredible book. We're coming at it from a rather oblique angle today. There are several things that I wanted to work in a very brief form. We talked a little bit about science a couple of days ago, the last time that we had together, and the idea that the universe had a beginning and will have an end, and how that lends itself to belief in the Creator, and how that was a conclusion that was not readily embraced by those people who were forced into that realization. Today we are specifically going to be talking about mankind, and in a way that I hope will lend itself to having confidence in the biblical account of man's origin and man's purpose. There are several things that I want to touch on. Again, it will be very, very briefly. I limited myself to only 13 slides for today's presentation, and on most days I've been able to get through 14 or 15 slides. However, in the teen class, I only got through 9 slides on this one, so I'm kind of verbose about the topic that I have here. There are a lot of things I'd like to say that I won't have time to say, and it is an area that I find particularly intriguing, particularly fascinating. Those of you who were here last week may remember the magazine cover that's presented for you up on the wall once again. Who were the first Americans? And the reason I presented that last week was to make the point that there are a lot of things in archaeology that are not really set hard and fast. There are a lot of areas where there are controversies and differences of interpretation, and where the evidence has not all been gathered in. A lot of questions yet to be answered. Whereas a few years ago, there was a belief that the story of how the American continents came to be settled was pretty much nailed down, and that 10 to 12,000 years ago, there had been people who migrated across a land bridge in the Bering Strait that worked their way down across the North American continent and into the Middle and South American areas. All that was thought to be pretty well sorted out, and so they weren't really looking for anything else. And when somebody decided to go ahead and look, they found more. And there are those today, and I do not accept these timetables, but just to use them to speak about what is said, there are those today who believe that there have been people on the American continents for on the order of 30,000 years, which is a whole lot more than 10,000. You can do the math on that yourself to see that it's a lot more. But the idea is that things are not nearly as simple as they once seemed to be. Nor is it at all clear who the first people were who came here and where they came from. And I said the other day that I really thought that the answer to that had to do with the events associated with the Tower of Babel, and that is the conclusion that I draw on that. But we will talk about that a little bit more further down the line. I want to ask a question right now, and we are going to try and connect it with some of the kinds of technologies that are involved in archaeology and paleontology and these sciences today. What is man? Well, of course, that question is asked in the Bible, and is also answered in the Bible. What is man? And furthermore, how many kinds of man are there? And how many kinds of man have there been? Now, in a way, that's a little bit loaded, because the word kind is used in a particular way in the Bible, isn't it? And in biblical terms, there is one kind of man. But in other terms, I'm going to call on one of my brothers for a little help.
In addition to thanking both of them for their wonderful job, I'd like to thank them for so politely bearing with my personal Neanderthal tendencies where computers are concerned.
All right. Do you remember that? That was Monday, the first Monday of the program here. And Rick commented that he had Neanderthal tendencies, and I believe that Glenn echoed and said that he had some also. Didn't you say something like that, Glenn?
Oh.
Well, when we use that language, and I don't have to ask Rick what he meant because everyone here understood what he meant. When we use that language, what are we talking about? Well, are we talking about a different kind of man? Well, no. Several people, when I said how many kinds of man are there, I saw some fingers going like this. There's one kind of man in the biblical sense. In fact, in Acts chapter 17, verse 26, Paul brings this full force into the New Testament dogma when at the Areopagus he says, "From one man God made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us." Now, we divide people into all kinds of categories today. We, of course, talk about male and female, but we also talk about black and white and various kinds of racial or ethnic distinctions or national distinctions or even distinctions of sexual preference or other kinds of distinctions that are drawn between types of people. How many types of people are there? If all men come from one man, and what Paul is talking about here, and I want to mention this now because I may not get to it in the latter part of the lesson today, Paul is talking here about the fact that all men of all nations come from one origin, one man that God originally made, that God originally created. When we look at that, we're looking at something that's very closely allied with a big part of what Rick was talking about today, which is providence. Why is it that we can have people with a set of physical characteristics like the Africans have, with the thicker lips and the different shape of nose and the darker skin, and at the same time we can have people with the characteristics that the Eskimos have, which are very different in some ways, or people who have the characteristics that the Europeans have, or that the Asians have, or whatever group of people you want to talk about? Why is it that we can have all those kinds of varieties of people if there's really only one kind of man in the first place? Well, that has to do with the way God designed things so that everyone could have their place, so that there would be room for all of these kinds. Well, there's that word that isn't really appropriately used in that respect. But there would be room for all varieties of humankind on the face of the earth. God designed us with a capacity for variation. But as we talk about this today, I want you to bear in mind from what Paul says, as well as a lot of other scriptures we could look at, that there is no room in a biblical frame of reference for anything resembling racism. There is no basis for it. There is no acceptance of it. There is no credibility for it in anything that we find in the biblical story. Everyone of every race is equally a man, equally a human being, and equally valuable in the sight of God and equal eternal potential in the plan of God. There is no variation whatsoever in the value of human beings or the potential that God has given to every one of us according to His design. So when we talk about mankind, and the variations within mankind, we need to bear that principle in mind, that by God's providence, there are different sorts of people to live in different places in this world. But that has no bearing whatsoever on their humanness or on their value. This little clipping is from the same magazine that has that cover about the first Americans. And if you can't read it, and some of you further back probably can't, it says, "For years, archaeologists at the Topper site in South Carolina saw no reason to dig below the level containing Native American artifacts. Last spring, they dug deeper and found a stone blade more than 12,000 years old." Well, I question, of course, the date on that, but I don't question the reality of the fact that there was older stuff to find than what they'd found before, because they had a pre-existing concept of what would be there, or in this case, of what would not be there. And very often, scientific inquiry, and medical inquiry too, as in Bible study too, is hampered by this kind of a mindset. We expect that we already know what's there, and so we don't look as deeply as we should. We don't ask the questions that we ought to, because we think we already know the answers. Well, one of the points that I certainly want to make today is that a lot of the answers that people have thought they knew simply were not right, simply were not adequate. In the last 10 years, the idea of what man is and where man came from in the materialistic evolutionary frame of reference has changed radically, and is still in a process of change today. From that same magazine article, there is a picture here that I wanted to share with you of three stages in reconstructing a human face. And I want us to think about how this process works. Over on the side here, there is a replica skull. Usually you don't work with an original ancient skull when you're doing something like this. You make a casting of it or you make a plastic model of it. But over here is a replica skull, and it has these little pegs that have been stuck around on the bony structure. And then, in the next step, clay is applied up to the depth of those pegs that have been placed around the bony structure. So what's going on there? They have these little pegs that represent the average depth of flesh on a human skull and face, the average depth of flesh. If you look around the room, you realize that we don't, any of us, conform precisely to such an average. There are quite a few variations in the amount of flesh that we pack on our faces. Some of it having to do with how much weight we carry, and some of it having to do with family characteristics. So So there are things that affect this, and we're only going to get a vague approximation of what the original face might have looked like by following this process. But you follow this process, you put the pegs on there, and then you start building the clay, and you end up with a face. But there are several things about that face that are still totally subjective. Not just a matter of averages that don't bear out in the experience of the ordinary man, but totally subjective. The other group had no problem telling me what some of those things were. How about you guys? What are some of the things that are totally subjective about the reconstruction? Go ahead.
Color.
There's no hint over here of what color the eyes should be, what color the skin should be. That's completely subjective. What else?
Nose.
The nose. There is no remains of the soft tissue to tell us how big or what shape the nose ought to be. Okay. Likewise with the ears. Shape and color of the eyes, those are empty sockets there. There's nothing there to really tell us very much about the shape, and certainly nothing about the color of the eyes. And of course, nothing about hair on the individual here, and so this particular man ended up without any. This is a piece of, it's actually several pieces of a skull that were turned up just a couple of years ago. It's called Agari, which is to say that it's included in the family that is called Australopithecines. I have it on here to show you and to bring your attention several things about what is often involved in reconstructing skulls from the very scanty, frequently very scanty remains that are often found. This particular specimen, if you can tell, and I know the further back in the room you are, the harder it's going to be to tell, but if you can tell, there are areas here of bone. And then again, there are areas here of blue modeling material. Now, what's the difference in those? What is the blue modeling material telling us? That all of that is, again, rather subjective. That's guesswork in putting that part of the face together. Now that the lights are out, you can also see that the part we do have is really lots of little pieces that have been put together. We talked about some of the challenges of working with puzzle pieces the other day and talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's hard enough when you're working with two-dimensional puzzles. It gets a lot more difficult when you are working with incomplete pieces of three-dimensional puzzles, because not only do you have to find edges that line up, you have to figure out just how much of an angle goes on those edges. And the amount of angle you put on it is going to have a big impact on the final results you get as to what the face, the head are shaped like, and what kind of cranial capacity the creature that originally wore those bones was going to have. In the case of an Australopithecine, it probably was going to be a cranial capacity something on the order of about 600 cc's, something like that. Now, I'm going to tell you just from the outset that when we are talking about Australopithecines, even though we very often see them in connection with the human family, there is no question in anyone's mind that Australopithecines are apes. This is the skull of an ape, and that is beyond doubt. No one thinks that an Australopithecine is not an ape. There is all kinds of discussion about various behaviors of Australopithecines and how they may have moved, how they may have walked, things along those lines, but there's no question that that was the skull of an ape. We have here from Genesis 2:19 a statement in the scriptures. Now the Lord God had formed out of the ground all the beasts of the field and all the birds of the air. He brought them to the man that Paul mentioned in Acts chapter 17, from the one man God made every nation. God brought the creatures to the man to see what he would name them. And whatever the man called each living creature, that was its name. And some kin of this creature must have been named by the man. I want us again to, whoever reached the light switch last time, I'd appreciate it if you could do it another time for me here. I want us again to look at these representatives, which are from the facing page in the same article. In a moment, the magazine cover will be up here that this article was in. We have here two skulls. Can you tell me which of those skulls is the human skull?
Yeah.
All right, you think it's the top one. What makes you think that? All right, the shape of the head. Good enough. Now, that's an old, broken-up skull. It's a skull that's been around for some pretty rough treatment and would be considered a part of the Homo erectus family as far as things that we're going to be talking about here shortly. The lower skull is, no surprise, an ape skull. It's a skull of an Australopithecine, the same family as that more fragmentary skull that I was showing you a moment ago. But you may be able to tell once again that there are large portions of this skull that have been reconstructed that are made of modeling clay rather than of actual bony fossil material. And I want you to bear that in mind, not because it means that we can't gain any information from it, but never forget how much subjective modeling is involved in recreating ancient things of this type. The Lord God had formed out of the ground all the beasts of the field and all the birds of the air. He brought them to the man. Right? This will be in the category of the beast of the field. This will be in the category of the man, to see what he would name them. There are a lot of things that can be said about these two different types of creature, and I'm going to say only a few of them. This is the cover of the magazine that those last few pictures came out of. It was on the magazine rack just a couple of weeks ago when I went shopping for a totally different kind of magazine, but knowing that I was doing a presentation that involved science and I was going to say a few things about the origin of man, this cover just kind of screamed at me and said, "Buy me!" And so I did, because it is such a wonderful picture. This is a beautiful picture of an Australopithecine. There's only a couple of problems with this picture of the Australopithecine. I said to you already that an Australopithecine is, without a doubt, an ape. There is no question that an Australopithecine is an ape. It has a skull capacity of about 600 cubic centimeters, roughly. That's an average that is guesstimated for the Australopithecine. If we talk about a modern chimpanzee, they average somewhere in the range of about 4 to 450 cubic centimeters. If we talk about a gorilla, they average somewhere around 550 centimeters. When we talk about human beings, they average from 700 to 2200. There's a wide range among humankind of the capacity of the skull, from 700 to 2200 centimeters, cubic centimeters, of brain capacity in here. Now, how effective are we, just on that one basis alone, to momentarily set aside our ape friends here, but how effective is it to determine intelligence based on skull size?
Not effective.
It's not effective at all. Not at all. If we go around the room here and take a survey based on brain size, we're going to come to the conclusion that men are significantly more intelligent than women, because men have bigger heads than women do. I think that the fair part of the audience isn't going to go along with that premise. And there's no reason why they should. There's no reason why they should. It isn't a matter of the size of the brain. It's a matter of the organization of the brain. And ape brains are not organized anything like human brains. There is none of the capacity that human beings have in ape brains. But as we look at this picture of our Australopithecine, this is supposed to be about 2.6 million years old, I want us to remember once again what the Bible says in terms of the origin of man, and then we're going to compare faces just a little bit. Rick mentioned the other day, when he was talking about the age of the earth, the word bara, which means created. In this passage in Genesis, we have that word here, and then we have that word here, and then we have that word here. And it seems like there was a real effort in the writing of the first chapter of Genesis to drive home the point, God created man. He created him. He created him. And when we come to the fifth chapter, it's repeated a couple more times. He created him. He created him. God wanted us to know with certainty that he was claiming to have brought us into being, not by any gradual process, but to have created us. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves along the ground." God did not say that to an Australopithecine. God said that to a man. Let's look at two apes here side by side and see what has happened in the subjective recreation of a modern artist. On this side, we have an ape of a type that you probably will recognize. What is that? A chimpanzee, all right? What kind of artistic license have we taken in this recreation of the ancient ape as compared with the modern ape? Those eyes, what a difference those eyes make. What can you tell about eyes from a fossil skull? Nothing. Nothing. What a difference it makes to put these human eyes into that face. What happened to Bobo's forehead here? That receding hairline makes a big difference in how we look at that fellow. What about that ridge? You remember that bony ridge on the two Australopithecine skulls that we looked at? For some reason, that's back here in the shadows, and it just doesn't seem to make that big of an impression about this guy. This guy looks kind of philosophical, kind of thoughtful, rather gentle, rather pleasant. And somehow the fringes of hair have ended up looking like something that a maestro might be wearing when he's conducting the orchestra, rather than looking like the garb of a wild animal. This is entirely subjective, and we need to appreciate the, I'll just use the word agenda, the agenda of someone who creates an image like this and puts it before the public. They have a package to sell. There are millions and millions of dollars in research money tied up in this, and I'm sure that doesn't motivate anyone, but it is a factor to bear in mind. The subjective depiction of the Australopithecines is tremendously misleading. Australopithecines, I've already said, had a brain capacity on the order of perhaps 600 cubic centimeters. They stood about 4 feet tall. They are supposed to have walked erect, but there's still a lot of questions in terms of that erect walking. And on the other hand, when we talk about walking erect, there are some chimps that do seem to walk erect on a bit more frequent basis than other chimps. So even that is not a very meaningful kind of point to make. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, God said, "Let us make man in our image." I thought it was going to die that way. We'll pause. Sure, it won't be on page, but okay.
That's cool. It's more than just research money, as you know, that Thomas Huxley himself, he said that the creator fable cannot be true or ever responsible for God. Something similar to that. Not just research money.
In a book by a man, a lawyer named Johnson, his first name escapes me at the moment. The title is Darwin on Trial. He talks quite a bit about
motivation.
We can't really hear what it's doing. It's on? Everyone in the back room say that it's on? Okay. God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. I wanted to mention the idea, and maybe you've heard of this, almost everyone in the young adult class has heard of this. Have you heard that there is only about a 1% difference between the DNA of humans and the DNA of chimpanzees, that 99% identity between the DNA, what are we doing with young adults in here, huh? 99% identity between the DNA of chimps and the DNA of humans. That being the case, you would think it'd be easy to turn this fellow into a human being. That was nifty. Do it again. No! It's not an easy thing to make a man out of a monkey. The fact is, from the best data that I could find, and I have looked for this for a long time, the best data that I could find, that notion that there is a 99% identity between the DNA of chimpanzees and the DNA of humans is based on a single experiment, and the experiment itself wasn't published. Only the conclusions of the men who did the experiment were published. And the conclusions that they published indicated a 96.2% identification of sameness between the DNA of chimpanzees and the DNA of humans. I want to talk about that for a couple of seconds. There are several things that we need to bear in mind there in talking about DNA. One is that when we talk about human DNA, we are talking about approximately 3 billion nucleotide base pairs. 3 billion. Okay, this is a huge amount of information in human DNA. And we'll just go ahead and grant that the chimpanzee has a similar number of base pairs there. The actual number, as I said, of identity is more like 96.2%. I'm going to round that off down, not because I need this favor, but just so I can work with the number 4 rather than a more complicated number. So there's about 4% of difference based on that number. 4% of difference between the DNA of humans and the DNA of chimpanzees. Now, there are still a lot of questions there, and if I can remember, I'm going to bring up some of them. But let's suppose there is about 4% of difference between the DNA of a chimpanzee and the DNA of a human being. All right? According to the premises of the people who believe that apes and humans have a common ancestor, that ancestry parted company about 4 million years ago. Now, if we are working with approximately a 4% difference in these nucleotide pairs, a 4% difference in these base pairs for the human chromosomes, and we have 3 billion of those to start with, then when we take 4% of those, we're talking about 120 million pairs, 120 million base pairs within each chromosome, 120 million. Now, if over a period of 4 million years those changes have been introduced, then on average, how many are introduced every year over the entirety of that 4 million year spectrum? A lot. 30. Okay, 30 a year. 30 changes in the DNA sequence per year over a period of 4 million. Now, obviously, or at least I hope it's obvious, that's nonsense. It's ridiculous. You can't bear live children with that kind of rate of change going on. Everything born is going to be born dead, and the species will become totally extinct in no time at all. You cannot have mutations of that magnitude. The evolutionary time scheme of just, you know, give us enough time and we'll make these things happen. Just talking about the idea that there is a 4% difference between human and chimpanzee DNA totally blows away the mathematical possibilities of apes and humans having a common ancestor 4 million years ago. It's just nonsense. It can't possibly work. That's not my number. It's one of the standard numbers that is used by current... Yes. In fact, the hip has a lot to do with it. But we won't get into that. It is not reasonable to suppose that human beings and apes have a common ancestor neither 4 million years ago nor 40 million years ago nor in any time frame whatsoever. There is another aspect to this DNA thing, and I think it's worth mentioning. When you read, and in the article that some of these illustrations were coming from, it's a very good article, in the article that some of these illustrations were coming from, you read, and this author cites that there is this 99% sameness between chimp DNA and human DNA. And then he says, but human DNA is arranged differently. Yes, it is. It is arranged quite differently in some very important respects, such as the fact, how many chromosomes does a human being have? I thought maybe I heard it. 23 pairs, 46 chromosomes. Human beings have 23 pairs, 46 chromosomes, and those chromosomes have all those billions of data bits in them. How many chromosomes do chimpanzees have? Well, I had to do a lot of looking for that too. That's not just out there everywhere, but they have 48 chromosomes. They have 24 pairs of chromosomes. So yes, it's packaged differently. Human beings have 23 pairs, and chimpanzees have 24 pairs. So yes, indeed, the DNA, these nucleotides, are certainly packaged differently in human beings and apes. Very differently. Very significantly differently. But we need to have a lot of commonality, not only with chimpanzees, but with other creatures on this earth. Why is that? Because otherwise we wouldn't be able to eat the food that's out there that we have to digest. It has to match up with our body in some very particular ways, or else we couldn't utilize the biological world around us. We need that similarity.
I have a question. Do scientists have some way of giving an acceptable number of changes to the age, as they would call it, from year to year?
You know, at one time, the accepted notion, Jay, was the idea of gradualism, just bit by bit and bit by bit. But because of problems like this, nowadays it's a lot more popular to believe in some sort of happy monster theory, punctuated equilibrium, sudden changes of large magnitude, which to me are tremendously hard to believe in or explain. But you tend to fall into, because of the difficulties of accumulating enough bit by bit, to fall into the idea that from time to time circumstances bring about some great spontaneous change, which there's no validation for that. It's totally hypothetical, but nevertheless, that's the direction you end up going. The Lord God formed the man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. And I want to put before you that there is no evidence to the contrary. Now, there certainly are interpretations to the contrary, but there is no evidence to the contrary. This chart is from the same magazine article. You may not be able to see it and read it, but there are several things about it that I wanted to point out, and so I'm going to use it, even though it may be too small for you to see from where you are. It's a very honest chart. I really appreciate the effort that went into it. Very often, when you go into a museum or even into a science textbook, you're going to find material that is nowhere near as current as this. You're going to find material that, in fact, is as much as 40 or 50 years out of date, sometimes even more than that, that depicts a chain of human evolution that absolutely no one believes in anymore, except for science teachers in classrooms who are not keeping up with what's going on. The human family tree, as depicted here, we have Homo sapiens, that is people like us up here, and down here there is a designation of 0.5 million years. So this is pictured way up toward the spectrum of just being maybe 30,000 years or so that Homo sapiens have been on the scene. Over across from the Homo sapiens, we have the Neanderthal, Homo neanderthalensis, who was not very good with a computer. But you will notice that he's pictured at almost the same height on the chart. And that was not a very popular idea for a long time. That was really bitterly contested and resisted. But there is no doubt of the overlap of what we would call ordinary human beings and Neanderthal-type human beings. There's no doubt of them living side by side in a lot of places. We come down the line here and we have a question mark, and that's one of the things that I really appreciated about this author. Down here we have Homo ergaster. Is that an E? I think it is. Ergaster, which is in the family of Homo erectus, and it shows here Homo erectus coming off of that branch, and shows a question mark over here. Just a few years ago, Homo erectus was considered to have become extinct about 500,000 years ago, but now Homo erectus is believed to extend all the way up into the same period as Neanderthal and Homo sapiens, that is to say, just 30 or 40, maybe 50,000 years ago that these folks were on the scene. I'm going to have some other things to say about this from my own perspective here shortly. But then we come down and we have Homo rudolfensis, who again should likely be in the same category as Homo erectus. Let me say a couple things about those right now. When we talk about Homo neanderthalensis, we are talking about people who, by and large, have bigger brains than you and I do. Except, well, they're dead. But they had bigger brains than you and I do, by and large. They also had heavier bones than you and I do, by and large. And they tended to be big people overall. When we talk about Homo erectus, again, we're talking about people who tended to be big overall, but their head size tended to be a little smaller. One author in particular, a creationist named Lubino, who wrote a book called Bones of Contention, suggests that basically Homo erectus and Homo neanderthalensis are the same thing, except that we're looking at the range of size in skull, in brain capacity, that we looked at today in modern humans. Like I said, we run all the way from about 700 all the way up to 2200 cc's in modern humans. So there is a vast range of sizes. But in looking at ancient man, there is this tendency to categorize according to the size of the skull, which would never work in looking at modern man. So we come down, and this Homo rudolfensis used to be considered, not over here where he is now, but used to be considered over here in a category called Homo habilis, along with a particular fossil found by Richard Leakey that was called 1470 Man. They were in a category sort of unto themselves. Now, there's a reason for that, and again, I want to point out there's a question mark here on the tree, there's a question mark here on the tree, there's a question mark here on the tree, there's a question mark here, and a question mark here, and a question mark here, and there are a lot of question marks up there. This is not a very definitive family tree because no one has one anymore. There isn't a very definitive evolutionary family tree anymore, because the more they find, the more complicated it gets, and the harder it is to sort all the pieces out, because we keep having these overlapping people who were supposed to be ancestral to one another. And the notion of ancestral forebears here just keeps falling to the wayside. It doesn't work. They were living side by side. They were sometimes mixing together, evidently. The same magazine has a picture of the fossil remains of a child that has all the appearance of being a mix of Homo sapiens and Homo neanderthalensis. So all of these things are up in the air and tremendously debated and discussed. But down here, we have the apes. That is to say, the Australopithecines of various sizes and types. And down below, we have Australopithecus afarensis, the gracile form of Australopithecine. And before it ever goes over here toward Homo, species Homo, I would appreciate if someone could bring me a drink of water. We have a question mark, because there is no known connection. There is only a guess connection between Australopithecines and human beings. There is no known connection. And then we look up here at Homo habilis, which is a species designation that was invented by Louis B. Leakey. Thank you. I am doubly blessed, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much. We have this category called Homo habilis, which was invented by Louis B. Leakey. And it is a very, very difficult category. I really appreciate this 1992 book that I was just mentioning to you, Bones of Contention, by Marvin Lubino, I believe is his name, because he talks about Homo habilis there, and he says Homo habilis is a bogus category. He says in Homo habilis you have these individuals who should be human, Homo erectus type, who would be about 6 foot tall, and on the other hand you have these other individuals who should be Australopithecines, about 4 feet tall, and you have people trying to explain this difference in these two by saying, well, this is sexual dimorphism. You know what sexual dimorphism means? No. It means that men are bigger than women. So you have 6 foot males and 4 foot women. That's going to work out real well, isn't it? That's not going to work out real well. And the fact is, he said this category should not even exist. And as I look at the chart that has been drawn for this article, here's a question mark here connecting it with the Australopithecines. Here is a line connecting it with Australopithecines. Here is a line connecting it with the humans, which is to say, sure enough, it's a bogus category. We have individuals in Homo habilis who should be over here and who should be over here, and they've been lumped together. Now, why do you lump these individuals together under Homo habilis? Well, because you don't like where they were found, mostly. When you find human remains and your dating methods put them beyond 2 million years, you don't like that, because Homo sapiens is not supposed to have been around for more than 2 million years. And so when you find human remains and the remains are too old, you have to have some place to put them. And so you put them in Homo habilis category. But just think in terms of that dating, and this is the one place where I'll really kind of focus on dating for just a moment. Just think in terms of that dating. In an article in Discover magazine, September 1994, the author had a lot to say about fossil dating and the difficulties of it. This is just a portion of what he said. Unless the age of a fossil can be determined, it hangs in limbo. Its importance and place in the larger scheme of human evolution forever undercut with doubt. Until researchers can devise better methods for dating bone directly, right now there are no techniques that can reliably date fossilized calcified bone more than 50,000 years old, a specimen's age has to be inferred from the geology that surrounds it. Well, when he talks about dating methods for specimens that are more than 50,000 years old, there's no dating method that can touch anything with any kind of reliable results more than about 2,000 years old. And I tried to kind of share that with you in talking about archaeology previously. When we talk about Egyptology, there are a lot of dates that seem to be very well fixed in Egyptology. You take remains that are known as to the time of their origin, biological remains, and you test them with carbon-14 dating, and you will not get the date that is known to be attached to the artifact. You will not, period. There is no dating method that will date anything effectively beyond a few hundred or maybe 2,000 years. We are working with guesswork in virtually all of the dating methods that we're talking about. And from time to time, that is acknowledged. When we try to date the bones, like the Homo rudolfensis skull, for example, or the 1470 skull that Richard Leakey found, what they do is they date the rocks that are found in association with that skull, because they can't date the skull. So they date the rocks. Now, what do you base the dating of the rocks on? Well, one of the things you base it on is the potassium-argon dating. And Rick made reference to that in regards to an island that had risen up out of the sea and of the known provenance and so forth. And I'm just going to share a little bit with you regarding the specimen called 1470 Man that Richard Leakey found. When he found this, it was announced that he had found a human skull with all the earmarks of being modern man, and it was 2.6 million years old. That's what was first announced. Then they backtracked on that and said, well, no, it's not modern man, it's Homo erectus. And then they backtracked on that and said, no, no, it's not Homo erectus, it's Homo habilis. And then they backtracked on the 2.6 million years old and said, no, it's not 2.6 million years old, it's 1.9 million years old. Because there was this furor, this uproar, this fighting, this infighting, this battling going on within the ranks of the paleontologists. Potassium-argon dating can, in theory, be used to date younger rock, but again, it cannot be used to date fossils directly. The ancient 1470 man found by Richard Leakey and assigned an age of 2.6 million years old was dated by this method, potassium-argon. There was a volcanic deposit there. The dating expert responsible, Professor E.T. Hall, reported recently that the first rock sample analyzed gave the impossible date of 220 million years. All right? Everybody knows in this community of anthropologists that humans have been around for about 2 million years. And so when you date the rocks that the fossil is found in and you get a date of 220 million years, you know that that's an impossible date. So you throw it out. This date was rejected simply because it did not fit in with the evolutionary ideas, and a second sample was analyzed. This gave the more acceptable date of 2.6 million years. Subsequent tests resulted in a range of dates from 290,000 years to 19.5 million years. Now, there's a pretty wide discrepancy between 290,000 and 220 million, but the same test produced both results, as well as a whole range of other results in between. Now, how do you know which one is right? Well, the one you like is the one that's right. And there's no way around that. The one you like is the one that's right. This example illustrates both the unreliability of the potassium-argon method and also the suspect manner in which evolutionists interpret the data. So we have a human family tree. It is filled with holes and questions and uncertainties and groupings that may or may not stand the test of just a few more fossils turning up. Many of them will not. On the other hand, we have this family tree. This is the written account of Adam's line. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them. And when they were created, he called them man. When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image. And he named him Seth. After Seth was born, Adam lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters, etc. In the image of God, he created him. He created them. Adam had a son in his own image. The bush has nothing to do with the reality of the human family tree and is unsupported by the evidence that is cited. There are no connections possible to be drawn in that area. On the other hand, there are differing human faces. And I want to remind us of that the Bible has said so all along. There are differing human faces. Not only what Paul says about every nation of men, but I invite you to turn and let's read from Genesis chapter 6 and verse 4. Yeah, we can have some lights for this part. It'll be another minute or two before we get to another spectacular picture. Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. Somebody who has it, read it out loud for me.
There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, the sons of God committed the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown.
All right, the mighty men of old, the men of renown. There were giants. What's the NIV have for that? Nephilim. And a lot of other translations do as well. I really prefer that because it doesn't carry with it connotations that tempt us to read too much into the expression. The word Nephilim doesn't mean giants. It is a word that is used distinctively a couple of times in Scripture, including this passage in Genesis 6:4, and then again Numbers chapter 13, verses 32 and 33. According to Genesis 6:4, where did the Nephilim come from? How did they come about?
God.
The sons of God and the daughters of men. Now it is my interpretation of that, that when it says sons of God, it's referring back to the last few verses of Genesis chapter 4, where the family of Seth begins to call on the name of the Lord. And when it refers to the daughters of men, it's referring to the other lineage there, which was isolated from them and is described in some detail there, and that is the lineage of Cain in the fourth chapter of Genesis. And I'm not going to get into a discussion of whether that's the only possible interpretation. I believe that's the correct interpretation there, and if you have a different feeling, that's your business for the time being. Steve?
Hybrid vigor.
As far as what comes of this union, there is some sort of an unusual outcome when these two isolated populations come together. And the Nephilim were in the earth in those days, and also afterward. This wasn't the only time that this happened, that this outcome occurred, but they were the mighty men of old. And when we go to Numbers chapter 13, verses 32 and 33, what's happening there? It's not yet. Numbers 13, this is the 12 spies. 12. 1, 2, 12. The 12 spies have gone into Canaan. And they said that they saw giants, Anakites. They saw these people there that made them feel small in their own eyes, and they were afraid to go and try to take the land. The cities were mighty, the people were large. It certainly was bountiful, but all in all, it looked to them like it was just too difficult. The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw were of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak came from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own sight. We move along to passages that are listed over here for Rephaites. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verses 10 and 11. Talks about the battles with the Rephaites and connects the Rephaites with the Nephilim. And then likewise, as we move down here through these passages, I want us to look at two particular passages and draw a connection. One, Joshua chapter 11, verses 21 and 22. Joshua chapter 11, verses 21 and 22. Country of Israel, Joshua totally destroyed them and their towns. All right, when the Israelites came and spied out the land in Numbers 13, and as they came in to battle in the land, there were Anakites there, and they were the children of the Nephilim, the descendants of the Nephilim. But Joshua waged war against the Anakites in the hill country of Israel and eliminated the Anakites from the hill country of Israel. But in verse 22 of Joshua 11, no Anakites were left in Israelite territory. Only in Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod did any survive. Whose territory is Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod? The Philistines, okay? This is Philistine territory that we're talking about then, that the Anakites have gone into as their last remaining outpost. Og is described as having been a Rephaite, one of the Anakites, one of the Nephilim, and his kingdom was ruled from Ashkelon, which was Philistine territory. So even Og had a strong foothold in the Philistine territory. Do we know about any big people that came out of Philistine territory? Goliath. Oh, sure. Goliath is a big guy that came out of Philistine territory. Goliath. Oh, sure. Goliath is a big guy that came out of Philistine territory. Let's go to 1 Chronicles chapter 20 and verses 4 through 8. 1 Chronicles chapter 20 and verses 4 through 8. In the course of time, this is in David's day, in the course of time, war broke out with the Philistines at Gezer. At that time, Sibekai the Hushite, I'll ask Rick to pronounce these words, how's that? The Hushathite killed Sipai, one of the descendants of the Rephaites, and the Philistines were subjugated. In another battle with the Philistines, Elhanan, son of Jair, killed Lami, the brother of Goliath the Gittite, who had a spear with a shaft like a weaver's rod. In another battle, which took place at Gath, there was a huge man with six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot, 24 in all. He also was descended from Rapha. When he taunted Israel, Jonathan, son of Shimei, David's brother, killed him. These were descendants of Rapha in Gath, and they fell at the hands of David and his men. Now, among the things that I see in the description here is that in the land of Canaan, in the days when the Israelites came there, and on up through the time of David, there were people there who were larger than the human norm. Now, I don't know with absolute certainty what the human norm was. I only know of the data from one excavation site where they actually published the sizes of the people from the excavation from old Israelite days. But that particular excavation site, the men averaged about 5.5 feet tall. Now, there are a variety of reasons why that would be the case. One of the reasons being that all indications of their bones and their teeth and so forth is that they were grain eaters. They didn't eat a lot of protein in the form of meat. They ate a lot of grain. Now, if you go to the Philippines, you know, Roger was here the other day, and he said when he's home, he's the center on the basketball team. I think he's about 5'9", something like that, because most of his people are not very tall. Why aren't they very tall? Is it because their genes don't support tallness? Well, that may not really be the whole story. Their diet has a lot to do with it. They are very heavy rice eaters, very little protein, very heavy rice eaters. We've seen in Japan, for example, the change of generations. As the diet has included more and more protein, the stature of the generations have gotten bigger and bigger. And so there's a real factor there. There is a genetic factor, but there also is a dietary factor. And the people in Israel during David's time may have been, and I only say may have been because I don't have enough data to make any sort of, you know, really firm conclusion on this, but may have been generally about 5.5 feet tall for the men. May have been. And that brings us to a point that I made the other day in talking about 1 Samuel. This, we ought to have the lights down for this. In 1 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 4, how do we go from Nephilim and Anakites to my son's wedding? Well, it's really not such a difficult transition. When I looked at this picture again, I thought this picture is just shouting for me to make use of it for the purposes of illustration. 1 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 4 in the Masoretic text, which all of our Bibles follow, says Goliath was 6 cubits and a span. And there are also several references there to the regalia that he carried, how heavy his armor was, how big his spear was, and so forth. 6 cubits and a span. And I pointed out to you that there is a textual difference there. The Septuagint says that Goliath was 4 cubits and a span. Josephus also says that Goliath was 4 cubits and a span. And the copy of Samuel with the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Qumran copy, also says that Goliath was 4 cubits and a span. And I think that for the first 4 centuries of the church, that when they taught Bible stories to their children, they taught that Goliath was 4 cubits and a span. And when I brought that idea up the other day, there were several people who thought, well, that's just not big enough to be very impressive. Well, I think it is. Thaddeus here would be not quite 4 cubits and a span. He's about 6'4", and he weighs about 300 pounds. Now, the Anakites, the Nephilim, were larger than average people. Joshua stands about 5'11", which would probably be about Saul's size, because he was head and shoulders taller. Jody here is about 5'3", but she was wearing 2 to 3 inch platforms under that dress, so she was standing 5'5" or 5'6". So when we think about the conflict there, this would be about how tall David was that day, probably. And this is one of the possibilities for how tall Goliath might have been that day if he was 4 cubits in a span. And folks, that's big enough. Rick was talking again this morning about providence. And in that story, there is no suggestion that a miracle took place. There's no suggestion that Goliath was anything but a big, strong man, a warrior from his youth, well equipped for war, and that David overcame him with a sling and a stone. There's nothing there of the miraculous. It is of the providence of God that God was on his side. But if you prefer the Masoretic text reading, I'm not going to quarrel with you about that. We don't have any remains of people who are 9.5 feet tall, but this is the proportional difference. Now we have David and Goliath in the traditional story in the way that we are familiar with it, and that's fine. We may find remains of people that were that large.
In the way that Thad keeps growing, he might get there.
Thaddeus will tell you, if you ask him, that he is not growing. The world around him is getting smaller all the time. Yes. It does give Og's bed size as being something like 13 feet long. It may not be a bed at all. It may be a sarcophagus that's being referred to there, especially since it says it remains until this day. It may be a monumental sarcophagus that's being referred to in reference to Og. And I think the NIV, or at least some of the newer NIVs, I think footnote that Og's bed, his bedstead, may actually be a sarcophagus with iron bindings on it that he was entombed in. Well, I don't want to leave you with the impression of my son as an oversized individual. We'll go to something not quite so attractive here. Differing human faces. The fact is, and I want us to appreciate this, whichever way you look at the Goliath story, that's not really the point. It's only part of the point. The point is, the Bible tells us that there were various types of humans living in those times, and some of them were bigger than others. And you know what paleontology tells us? It tells us the same thing. There were different types of humans alive at the same time, and some of them were bigger and stronger than others. And Neanderthals were considerably stronger. You can tell that from the bones and from where the tendons attached and from looking at their tools and their way of life. They weren't stupid. They were not uncivilized. They had culture. They made music. They have found that they thought for a long time, those Neanderthals, bunch of dummies, you know. But they have found musical instruments crafted by Neanderthals. They have found finely designed tools and weapons used by the Neanderthals. The burial sites, in some instances, would indicate religious beliefs and so on and so forth. Neanderthals were people. And one of the questions that I wanted to ask when I was wondering whether it was possible that the Nephilim might be people like Neanderthals and Homo erectus, those kinds of fossils, one of the questions I needed to answer was, were there Neanderthals and Homo erectus individuals? Have their remains been found in Israel? Yes, very definitely. It's one of the primary sources, one of the places where Neanderthals have been found in relative abundance is in caves and tombs in Israel. And I am waiting for the day, and I believe the day is going to come, when in the excavations that are taking place at some of the Philistine sites right now, going on today, that they are going to finally get around to looking through some of the tombs and graveyards and start turning up bones that are awfully hard to explain from an evolutionary perspective, because they aren't supposed to be where they are from an evolutionary perspective. But the Bible indicates to us that Homo erectus here and Neanderthal here and Homo sapiens sapiens here, that these people indeed are reasonably understood as living side by side, often in competition with each other, in violent competition with each other, and that this is nothing that is strange to the biblical account of the way mankind was in the past. These are the remains of a Homo erectus boy, a teenager, who was about 6 feet tall. And I put his remains up here beside this passage from 2 Samuel that talks about some of those descendants of Rapha and how big and how strong they were, just to drive home that point a little bit more. I got even less far in here than I did with the young adults. So we'll leave it at that, and I won't revisit this tomorrow. But I hope that you can appreciate, in terms of God's incredible book, that in fact there is nothing out there that doesn't dovetail with things the Bible says. Whatever you thought about the little Goliath illustration there, there is nothing out there in paleontology, in any field, that doesn't dovetail with what the Bible says. There are certainly things out there the Bible doesn't talk about, but what the Bible does talk about fits the world that we know. And when men offer other interpretations, we should appreciate that their interpretations are very far afield, very difficult to support, and filled with contradictions of all sorts. And I've only tried to share a few of those kinds of things with you today. David told me who was going to do the closing, but I've totally forgotten. Craig Hensley, that's right. Craig Hensley is going to do the closing for us this afternoon. We might have the lights back up.